to show you.
All right, welcome to the 32nd episode of The Sirens of Scream, the geek podcast that proves sometimes dead is better. I'm Jackie DeVore, and I'm here with Sierra Halk.
Hello.
And Melissa Megan.
Hey, hey.
And today we are joined by our favorite historian, June Gregory.
Hello.
Welcome back, Anna. June.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Every time I speak, dog. It is setting this dog off. I get her out of here.
I think the dog wants to be on the show.
I think so.
Maybe we should just introduce the dog. So.
Well, the dog is out. Yeah. Not sure. It seemed like any time I would change the pitch of my voice or anything, she was freaking out. Okay. Well, thanks for having me back, guys.
Well, today we're going to be talking about the history of creepy clowns, which should be fun. But before we get there, we have some questions for you, June, but they're different from the last ones that we asked you.
All right. What do you got?
So the first one is, there are zombies at your doorstep. What weapon do you grab first, and how do you escape your house without being seen?
Oh, without being seen. Ooh. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, if they're at my door, then I'm pretty close to the kitchen, and you got to go for their head. So I've got to get, like, an ice pick and some long, skinnier knives. Then I'm going to run outside, probably. I'm just thinking, Ooh, and then I'm going to try to probably act like one of the zombies. I've seen that in a few shows and movies. Yeah. But that's what I'm going to do.
I like the amount of detail you're putting into that. I like that.
Survival.
It's actually what I was thinking when I made that question, was I was hoping people would kind of like map it out through their house. Yeah. But you'd be the only one that's done that so far.
All right, so the next one is, which horror movie monster would you want to be? And that can be realistic, and which one you would want to be, kind of thing.
Oh, man. That's a really good question. You know, I'm going to say a vampire, probably, of some sort. And I'm trying to think. I want to live a long time. And I want to be stylish. But yeah, in my heart of hearts, I think that's where I'd be.
Right on. I'm with you there. I would be a vampire, too. And what is the first horror movie you remember watching?
Oh, it wasn't even really scary at the time, either. But I think that Troll 2, actually.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, with my brother.
Nice.
I know it wouldn't have been the first one, but it's the first, I think, memory of actually the experience of sitting down and watching a movie in its entirety.
Cool. All right. Before we get into our topic, we are also going to do recommendations. Sierra, do you want to start us out?
Yeah. So Melissa and I tried to record a bonus episode while we were on break because of weather stuff. And then because of audio problems, it probably isn't good. So instead of just like re-talking about that stuff, I'd rather talk about one of my favorite Stephen King things ever, because everybody's talking about it and we're going to talk about it. But I'm a big fan of the other story that's based in Derry, Maine, which is also about a group of friends who are connected through some supernatural powers, and they go back to Maine when they're adults, fight an evil together, and that is Dreamcatcher. And I think the movie Dreamcatcher is kind of shitty. It's like it's not bad, but it's not like so great that you want to watch it a bunch of times or like talk about it or anything, but I think that
acknowledge it exists.
Yeah, it kind of gets out, but I think that the book is really fun and it reads pretty similarly to it, but it's not 1,000 pages long, so it's a little easier to wrap your head around. And I think that if anybody is excited about it right now and they want to have something kind of in the same setting and the same themes, reading Dreamcatcher would be a really cool idea.
Nice.
Yeah, I really like the mythology of Derry, revisiting that with it. And I had no idea that there was another story that took place there.
Yeah.
I actually hadn't read that one, but did see the movie. Yeah,
I think the movie doesn't really do it justice, as with many Stephen King movie adaptions.
Yeah.
I think that there are technically three books that are based in Derry. The other one is called, I want to say, like, Sleepwalking.
Is it Insomnia?
Insomnia. Yep, that's it. And okay. That book's my least favorite of the three that are based in Derry. Mm-hmm. It's not it's not the same kind of setup that the other two are, where it's like childhood and adulthood mirroring each other. That one is just like, it feels completely different.
It's like most, I think all the characters are senior citizens, quite advanced and aged. And yeah, I think Mike Hanlon shows up in that from It.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I think he trains another librarian. I have to double check that. Yeah.
When I saw the new It twice, the weekend it came out and then this weekend, I noticed in the second time seeing it that at one point, Bill is wearing a t-shirt for the Tractor Brothers Trucking Co. And that is a setting, the like offices of the Tractor Brothers is a setting in Dreamcatcher.
Oh, nice.
And I saw that and I got all excited. Because I was like, oh, it's in Derry.
That's a cute little nod to the universe.
I know. There. And then I decided I needed to talk about Dreamcatcher because I really love it.
Well, that's a nice segue into Melissa's recommendation.
Yeah, this is kind of a cheap add-in here, but I have to do it. I'm going to recommend It, even though we're going to talk about it a ton in this show, so I'm not going to say a lot. I'm just going to say that I was a big fan of It as a kid. I don't think it holds up well at all, the original film.
Mm-hmm.
It's not scary anymore, except for Tim Curry, because he's always scary.
He does a good job.
Yeah, no, the new It, my quick review is that I give it a solid B+, and I think that the new version of Pennywise is pretty fantastic.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
I keep hearing Skarsgård is amazing in it.
I think he is. My husband and I have caught ourselves like making little references to things that he says in the film over and over again.
That's a good sign.
Like little sound bites that we remember. Yeah.
Nice.
It's pretty unforgettable version of Pennywise. I think he did an amazing job of like establishing a new Pennywise without making it feel like a repetition of the old one. They're just different versions.
Mm-hmm.
This is an unintentional clown joke, but I'm going to say it anyway. He had big shoes to fill.
Oh.
I've actually heard that one made a couple of times in conversation about this movie.
Still good.
The best way I could think to explain the differences in my head anyway is that I feel like Tim Curry's Pennywise is sort of like a John Wayne Gacy Pennywise.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
He's a realistic sort of skeevy, gross kind of, but more human Pennywise. This new Pennywise is decidedly not human, like much more, does a much better job of like relaying that this creature is from some other world and it's kind of trying to imitate a human.
Interesting.
And it's obvious. It's really disconcerting. But I'm not going to say much more on that because we're going to talk about it more later. All right. But I have to recommend
it. So what's your other recommendation?
Okay, my other one is something sexy, which this topic is not really sexy. So I'm going to make it confusing. I'm going to recommend a comic book series called Insects. And this was actually recommended on our show once before, I think from one of our Witch Files friends. But I haven't read it until recently, and I read the entire series. It's up to, I believe, issue number 12 right now. I read this entire series like in the last 3 days. I just got so sucked into it, I couldn't stop reading. And it's spelled Insects.
Right on.
Insects. I'll read you a quick description of it. At the dusk of a century, a pair of vengeful Victorian vixens discover a horrifying power that transforms them into rich and strange new creatures. Armed with their dark, evolving forms, they descend into a world of the cultured and occult, with new senses and new sensuality to forge a life for themselves and the child of their love. So it's basically about two super strong-willed feminist women in the Victorian age who can turn into terrifying insects.
Nice.
Yeah, and they decide to they have a child, and they decide to go out and stand up for, protect, and seek vengeance for various women who have been wronged and abused in the world. And yeah, they're pretty badass. This book manages to put in all kinds of different feminist talking points. A lot of heavy information is worked into this story in the form of like a horror tale.
Huh.
It got a lot more horror than I expected it to, which is why I decided that I had to recommend it here.
Sounds pretty cool. It sounds like a very unique story.
It's an erotic comic book. I will say that it is 100% adult erotic comic book. Like, there's a super sexy lesbian love scene in pretty much every issue of this story. It's fantastic. And there's so many great characters in here. It's just not like anything I've ever read before.
Nice. Well, coincidentally, as we're talking here, I do things with my hands every time we're doing an episode. So today it's sketching. And I'm sitting here sketching out a big scary spider, which I'm going to make for my Halloween display this year. Making PVC pipe for legs kind of thing, like 12 feet tall sort of spider. Which, you guys know that I hate spiders, but Halloween is for being scared, and that's what scares me, so.
Yeah.
And that's kind of appropriate with it.
Yeah. I think all of you, it's appropriate with insects as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think all of you would love this series. It's written by Marguerite Bennett, and she's an incredibly talented writer. Yeah.
Cool.
You guys should read it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna throw in my recommendations here. One of them is the artist Belle D, who I think is based out of Asheville, which is what I consider my hometown there, and definitely June's hometown. She does these really cool cartoony old style Halloween sort of sketches, and they're a lot of fun. They're like, if you love the like vintage Halloween kind of feel, then you'll absolutely love Belle D. So we'll put that link there in the episode description. But the other recommendation I have is something that all of us sirens have been talking about, I think individually, but I don't think we've actually had a conversation about it together yet. And that's Dear David, which is so weird. I don't know if any of our listeners have been following along this, but Adam Ellis is a cartoonist. He works for BuzzFeed a lot. So he's got a good amount of name recognition on platforms like Facebook and Twitter these days. But he is convinced that he's being haunted by this child with a gigantic misshapen head called Dear David. And he's been chronicling his haunting on Twitter, and it is honestly fascinating. Like, if this is a hoax, then it is the most elaborate and interesting hoax I've ever seen. We'll send a link of the, he's got a Storyfy page that chronicles the whole thing, like all the posts together. But every few weeks he'll pop up with, oh, Dear David showed up again, and he will show whatever kind of incident happened then. He has attached video cameras to his cat collars. He has a nanny cam in his living room now that turns on anytime there's movement or sound in his house. So you can see like nothing going on in the living room, and then all of a sudden something falling off of a shelf and breaking for no reason at all. Or a rocking chair being like unnaturally moved in a completely still room, or, you know, various things like that. The cats have clearly reacted to things in the room. Like every night at the same time, they'll go to the front door of his apartment, and it all combines into a very eerie story. Like it's very strange. You guys have thoughts on this?
Well, as a person who super loves found footage horror, I feel like it's life. It's like we're living a found footage movie right now, just like reading his Twitter. It's really fun. That's
exactly what it's like.
When it first started happening, I thought it was for attention. I thought it was just, he was just making it up. And I was kind of salty about it. I was like, people don't know what real hauntings are like. And they don't know. This is just an urban legend. It has a lot of the same tropes. But I've really enjoyed seeing, like, he's taken... There's a lot of activity around like the hallway leading up to his front door, which like the cats are attracted to. And so he's taken pictures of that area. And when he takes it with his phone, it's like completely normal. And then he takes a Polaroid and it's just pitch black. And like that kind of physical, like that's a bizarre thing that like I wouldn't think of making up. And then to, like,
it's such an unnatural black too. Yeah. It's like not like it's dark. It's just like
nothing. Black. Like it's super weird.
It's creepy.
Yeah.
So yeah, even if it is just fabricated, it's done really, really well.
I've not heard of this, but I'm intrigued and I'm definitely going to look into
it. Yeah, you're going to love this. It's honestly gotten to the point where if he doesn't post on Twitter or Facebook for like a week or so, I start worrying about Adam Ellis. I'm like, oh no, is he okay? Did your David get to him? What's going on over there?
It's fun to read, and there's not so much that, I mean, you can read it very quickly, you know, like 30 minutes.
Yeah, but I like that he keeps posting updates. Like, this is definitely one of those, like, things that are happening in real time that I think has so many people's attention. It's very cool. It's like a horror story. A little, like Sierra said, like a found footage story playing out in real life. I dig it.
I just hope he continues it after everything stops so that he can keep entertaining me with it. Just start making the stuff up after this. I don't care. Yeah,
honestly, if it does end up being all made up, I am not even going to be mad about it because it has been that entertaining. So, June, do you have any recommendations for us?
Dude, the first is a book, and it sounds silly, but it's very well written and I think a legit scholarly publication. It certainly helped me out a lot and led me into some really interesting research, and it covers every aspect of clown weirdness that you could want to touch on. The title of the book is Bad Clowns by Benjamin Radford, and this is published 2016 by the University of New Mexico Press. And he talks about not just scary killer clowns, but clown porn. Clowns that are just bad. Like, okay, I don't know if any of you remember Shakes the Clown, but you know, the trope of substance abuse clown, things like that. Clowns in comics and history. And he also talks about the killer clowns, the molester clowns. Anything about clown weirdness you would want to wonder about is in this book, and it's very well written.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And I'm going to include this with the other books that and articles that I have that I think listeners will find interesting. And in the past couple of weeks, I've been, you know, kind of watching clown movies, you know, reviewing some old ones and ones that I haven't seen. But I came across one called Simply Clown. It's on Netflix right now. And it's an Eli Roth film. I believe this is 2014. Eli Roth got the idea for the movie because somebody made a fake trailer about a clown costume that you put it on and it kind of grows on you. Like, literally, you can't ever take it off again, and you're transformed into a clown demon. Nice. Well, Roth ends up seeing this trailer, and he's like, you know what? I think I'm going to make this film, but I'm going to take this concept and make it very serious. And it's really good. I like this whole idea of the haunted costume and the clown nose that grafts onto your skin, and you have to cut your nose off to get it off. And it's very silly, but it's very good example of body horror, too. It's ridiculous, and it's among my top four or five clown movies. It's on Netflix right now, so I think you should check it out.
Very cool.
Yeah. And I think that's it for my clowny recommendations.
Well, then we are going to take a quick break, and then we'll get back into our episode here. Maybe it's a constant smiling and laughing. Maybe it's a trickster nature. Whatever it is, there's something undeniably creepy about clowns. And it's not just a handful of us that think so. Being afraid of clowns is so common there's a word for it, colorophobia. Clowns typically fall into the horror trope staple, the uncanny. They're a familiar humanoid shape, but their obscured face is enough to give you the creeps. The depiction of evil clowns has become so ingrained in horror these days that there is literally a Wikipedia page listing hundreds of evil clown sightings in 2016 alone, which is just terrifying of itself. Of course, the clown that's on all of our minds right now is the one in theaters again after a couple decades. So let's start this creepy clowning off with a question. Its eponymous character, also known as Pennywise the Clown, appears to its victims as a representation of something that would lure impressionable minds to itself. So if Pennywise were to appear to you, what would it appear as?
To lure me? Mm-hmm. Oh, a basket of kittens. I'm mad go right for it.
I love
it.
That. I absolutely love that.
And then they'd have to change, of course, and have like the razor teeth.
Yeah. That like decaying in your hands.
Monster claws. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was thinking that if Pennywise was going to become like my greatest fear or something like that, then it would either be like somebody vomiting and like just projectile like disgustingness, or so like kind of like Eddie's leper that we see in the new movie, or it would be like somebody who's just like very angry and disappointed in me, and I like have to convince them that I'm like not terrible and that I'm not like a waste of time or something. Like they're just like very mad at me.
That just makes me want to give you a hug.
Aww.
Well, I think, and that's a good point. If Pennywise is trying to like get you know in on my greatest fears, I think if it did some crazy doppelganger mirror thing, that would scare me pretty good.
Yeah. How about you, Melissa?
He'd probably lure me with like ferrets, or probably like a crying child or something. You know, a child that's hurt or crying, because I wouldn't be able to resist. Helping. There's a lot of things I'm afraid of. I don't know what to pick. Anything that moves the way that Pennywise moves, it doesn't really matter what it is. And Jackie hasn't seen it yet, but it's that kind of like they used for what's her name in The Ring.
Like that disjointed kind of
unnatural
sort of.
Yeah, and he starts out really slow and then just like all of a sudden pounces on you and like that's really like that. Jittery.
Yeah,
nice.
That was horrifying.
And I think that, yeah, that the movement of the newest Pennywise really plays up that, like what Melissa was saying, trying to be human. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it looks incredibly unnatural.
Yes.
And wrong. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what the, like, I could say a spider, that would probably work pretty well, but I don't know. I'm always finding new things that I'm terrified of. So.
Same.
Pretty much anything that moves really weird or like makes like whispery ghost sounds, I would curl up into a fetal position.
How about we like roll all of those things you just mentioned into one, and it would be one gigantic nightmare machine?
It's basically Pennywise.
Sorry about the sleep you're gonna lose tonight, but. Yeah, for me, it would probably be, you know, little baby bunnies that turned into a gigantic spider.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Like furry little things with spindly legs that pop out the side.
Oof. Oh, God. Oh, God. No. Oh, jeez.
Have you seen that thing rolling around saying that spiders actually have cute little paws and so you should...
No!
You should love them. Okay. And I'm like, no! Just because their feet look like furry little paws under a microscope doesn't mean that I feel better about them.
They're still demons from hell. Like, that's what they are. Yeah. Like, just little tiny demons from hell.
When's the last time? Well, I guess we'll see soon, but I was just thinking, there hasn't been a good spider movie in a while.
Let's hope there never is another one again.
Well, you know, I'm a little partial to my eight-legged...
Every time, like, a spider thing makes my skin crawl, I immediately think, but June would love this. So while we're on the topic of It, how about the difference between the novel and the film's It?
Well, right off the bat, I can say that there's, and you can't put it in a movie. I mean, it's too much, but there's this underlying mythology about it, you know, where he comes from, and he has this nemesis. It's the great turtle Maturin, and there's this weird almost vision quest kind of aspect of the book that you'll never see. The Losers Club are guided by, my memory's a little foggy about it. The turtle's name is Maturin, I'm not sure how you say it, but he comes from the same dimension, I guess you could say, as Pennywise does. And it's kind of like a dualistic, you know, good versus evil thing. But the turtle is able to guide the children to some extent. And there's some weird things. Like, I think it might be Mike and Bill who make like a smoke tent and have hallucinations. And there's a ritual of Chud and some strange others, even a underage sex ritual of sorts that comes into the book that, yeah, so some really weird stuff that you're not going to see in any of the films.
Stephen King has been under fire lately because of that underage sex scene. And yes. I mean, apparently he was back when the original It, the movie, came out, and now it's just kind of starting again. But his response to it this time was, it's weird that you guys are totally okay with all the child murders, but this you have a question about.
Right. Sure, turn right back on us, baby. Well, you're the one who wrote the weird orgy in the sewer.
At least it was kid, but yeah, that was weird. Yeah. But yeah, consensual underage sex, or, you know, children getting their limbs ripped off and terrified to the point of death. I can see why they left that one scene out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Certainly.
I haven't read the book since I was really young, and I did not have nearly enough time to reread that book before we did this show. So I couldn't remember very much of it, honestly. I had a conversation about it to try to help me kind of remember some, but I really don't remember the orgy thing. I pretty much had to go into it, you know, just comparing it to the original miniseries.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, which in some ways is a little truer to the book, in some ways less. One big difference I noticed between the book and both of the film adaptations were the parents of these children. Okay, so Bev has a mom. She doesn't in either of the films, and the mom is nowhere near as malicious or abusive as her father. I wondered why the mother was left out, because in some ways, to me, it's more terrifying that there's a mom who's aware, and she's aware in the book that something is very wrong. I mean, besides just the bruises, that there may be a deeper element to the kind of abuse that Bev endures. To me, that's almost scarier that there's a mom who's not doing anything. Mike Hanlon has parents. It's another difference. In the miniseries, they put Ben in a home with his aunt and a mean cousin, and there's some welfare troubles or something like that.
Yeah, they mentioned that in the original movie a little bit. It shows Ben getting upset with his cousin and breaking something, and then his aunt, his mother's still there, but his aunt kind of freaks out over it. But they don't go into it any farther than that. So it seems like there was like more behind that little blip that they put into the movie.
And I feel like in the miniseries, they did more of a job of talking about how there's something wrong with dairy. I mean, other than just, okay, every 27 years, these occurrences, but people just not being like, hey, this is, you know, way above the average rate of murder or missing children, that there's kind of a willful ignorance as to what's going on. And I didn't see that in the new film.
I don't necessarily agree with that. I feel like, I don't know. I remember, you guys have to excuse me. I need to look up the names because I'm going to be terrible about all these names. I remember them talking about the, what's his name? Little fat kid. They kept referring him to as new kid. Was that Ben?
Oh, Ben, yeah.
I mean, he mentioned that, you know, to the kids, like, that he saw all this information and that nobody was talking about it. Nobody seemed to acknowledge that any of it was happening.
That's true. Do you remember that scene?
And then they kind of made a point a few times, I felt like, to show you that the parents weren't noticing. Like when the bullies were attacking Ben and the car kind of drives by and the parents, the adults just sort of glance at them, and then you see the balloon in the back window.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like that was the point of that, was to kind of say, hey, they're not paying attention because Pennywise has pulled the wool over everybody's eyes in this town. Yeah, everybody's like under some kind of weird trance.
So it's there, but more subtle, basically.
Well, and I just thought of a subtle example to her point that there's, when Bev goes into her house at one point, that weird television show. Mm-hmm. The second time I watched the newest one, if you look, like, her dad's watching the show that's like, go play in the sewers. And it ends up being the same program that
the clown,
the Bowers family watches.
Yeah. The one with the woman saying, kill everybody.
With the little jumping ball.
Kill them all. Yeah, kill them all.
Kill them all.
Well, that sounds fun.
Yeah, you're right. There are some references. Yeah, and it's more subtle that there's something is a little off and dairy.
There's something in the water.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like I got the idea, and I didn't rewatch the miniseries fairly recently, so yeah. I was kind of relying on my terrible memory, but maybe they did a better job of it before.
Well, you know, I think one thing I'm thinking, especially in the original miniseries, is like, I think it's one of the very opening scenes where there's been at the time of the film, a modern day killing, and Mike is really frustrated the police that they're just not, you know, involving themselves enough or kind of letting it go.
Yeah, the police basically Mike tell. Is like a... Sorry, go ahead, Sierra.
Oh, I was saying Mike kind of took it upon himself to like be a detective because the police just weren't doing a job. They just weren't doing it.
Yeah, the police officer there like specifically told Mike to go away. The police will handle this. And Mike's like, well, you're not really handling it, but okay.
Mm-hmm. Considering there was like another murder like a week before or something like that.
Yeah.
That tips him off that it's back. But
I definitely feel like this movie is going to be one that it's got a lot of things hidden in it. So, you know, when you watch it a few times, because I know that I only saw it once, but I know that there were things that I missed. My husband pointed out that in the library scene with Ben, when he's flipping through the old newspaper articles, that you could see the librarian in the background. She's kind of blurred out, but her face sort of with a big smile on her face, like watching him.
Oh, weird.
Like her face was kind of like,
well, that's
like she, her face was kind of like doing a Pennywise thing. And I totally didn't see it at all. I had no idea because I was so entranced with watching the pages turn that he was looking at. So I feel like every time you watch this movie, you might find like different details that are missed.
Mm-hmm. There's tons of Easter eggs in there, and there's lots of turtle references, which I like because I think it's telling, you know, fans of it and the novel, like, we know that you know that a turtle has a lot to do with this. It's too weird to put in the movie, but we're gonna, you know, you know, throw out some turtles randomly, and you know, I appreciated that. And, you know, one difference that just occurred to me in the miniseries, the intervals of time that it comes out to feed is 30 years versus like 27.
27 was too weird of a number.
Too hard of, but I wonder, is 27 chosen by Stephen King? Because isn't it the 27 Club? All the musicians who die?
Yeah, that's...
Because he's written a lot of short stories about the 27 Club, and I just wonder, it just popped into my mind.
Also, I'm pretty sure the actor who played Bill in the miniseries killed himself when he was 27, too.
Yeah, Jonathan Brandis.
Currently, Bill Skarsgård is 27 years old.
Uh-oh.
The release of the movie, yeah.
Oh, here we go. I just found something on it. Let's see. The movie is set to be released 27 years after the original TV release. In the book, it's mentioned that it returns Derry 27 years. Jonathan Brandis, who played young Bill in the original film, died at 27 years old. This movie released 1 month after Bill Skarsgård's 27th birthday. So, yeah.
Oh, wow.
There's a lot of 27 in
there. That's
creepy. Oh, here's a fun little thing about the new one. So, there's, not to give too much away, but the new Pennywise can do something interesting with his eyes, which I think really steps up his his whole...
Gross.
So it turns out that Bill Skarsgård can do this deviation of the eyes. And when he was talking, you know, potentially being cast for this role and ideas they had, he was like, well, check out what I can do. And they were like,
oh, no.
Kind of rolled with that. I've been seeing a lot of footage about this scary smile that he does, but I don't think it compares to somebody who can shoot their eyes in funny ways. So I think that was a really neat, you know, little tweak on the Pennywise look.
It sounds like the remake has a lot better direction than the original. Looking up here, Andy Muschietti is the director of the remake. He also did Mama, and he is doing the Lock and Key TV series.
Oh,
I didn't know that was going to be a thing.
Yeah. Oh, and apparently
I'm a big
fan. It Chapter 2 has already been announced.
Mm-hmm.
And he's directing that too. The original, though, let's talk about the direction in that, because honestly, I just rewatched that last week, and man, some of that direction does not hold up.
So night and day, also, to see the children actors in the original versus the kid actors in this new one.
Yeah.
The kids do such a good job in this new one, and I think that it doesn't help that the original miniseries had to be, like, okay for television. So, like, the kids were kind of held back with, like, a lot of the swearing and, like, the kind of Stephen King way that kids talk.
Right.
And the way that they kind of talk like adults. Yeah, the kids in the miniseries are just so, like, overdramatic and, like, soap opera acting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and honestly, I think the adults in the miniseries are worse than the kids. Like, they're just so cheesy. They're so bad. And there are, like, some weird musical cues that are just a bit much and not in a good way.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, I was noticing that, too.
Yeah.
Those nostalgia songs. And I think Tim Curry, you know, because Tim Curry and Stephen King have both been asked recently, like, well, how's that 1990s, you know, miniseries holding up in your opinion? And Tim Curry was like, it'd still be okay. They just, the ending was just awful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Stephen King's like, just bless its heart. It was a TV movie. You know, they did all, you know, they
it's
could.
It tried its best. It was certainly very early 90s, late 80s, that's for sure.
When the miniature Pennywise goes down the drain in the first battle, that one just, seeing that again. Ooh.
Yeah.
I have to say that was not a favorite of mine in the new film. I was not, I've always cried through that scene with Georgie in the original.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I think that the new one, I don't know, that level of brutality to me was just unnecessary. Oh. And I just, yeah. I had a really hard time with that. Like, it really stuck with me through the rest of the movie.
That hit me, too.
I get why they did it, but I really don't want to see that extent of violence against a kid drawn out that way. But I'm a big sissy because I'm a mom now, so...
No, the Georgie, the whole thing, it's just heartbreaking.
That is one thing that I feel like they got really right in the original miniseries was the opening Georgie scenes. Mm-hmm. Like, that was so perfect and was so perfectly done.
Well, and that's why I think it's really smart in this remake that, like, that they grabbed that moment and that they used it over and over again throughout the film.
Mm-hmm.
It was used as such a powerful tool for all of the kids, even just conversationally, you know, the many, many times that Georgie comes up in conversation between the kids. It's used to a much higher extent in this film than it was in the original one, which I think was really smart because they realized that was the most emotionally heavy and disturbing portion of the film to begin with. So,
mm-hmm. You know, and my one, I guess, negative critique of the new film was just that the battle scenes, the one in the house on Nabolt Street and then the one in the sewers, just didn't seem, they just didn't work. I don't know, they didn't gel for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure, they're different, and I think quite a few ways from the book. I'm just not sure how it's gonna pull off at the end in the sequel.
Did they feel a little, like, less brutal than they should have been for the foe that they were facing?
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of putting it. In the first scene where he, you know, he just gets injured and kind of slinks off, that was a little better, but yeah, I just wasn't, yeah, there should have been more.
Yeah, they felt each, I mean, for the many times that they faced off with him, it felt like there wasn't a whole lot of punishment or injury that happened the majority of the time. Like when you see this Pennywise, right, he's not, he moves very quickly and he's very aggressive. So, I mean, I guess the point being that they want you to feel like he enjoys the process of scaring them as much, if not more, than the actual physical violence. So he's trying to intentionally draw that out and make it last. And it's not about just killing them, but it's about sort of tenderizing the meat.
Oh, that's right. That the fear of fear that children have is salt for the meat or something like that. Yeah. He's eating the fear as much as the other stuff.
Right, because I feel like he probably could have killed them a lot faster.
Yeah, definitely.
But then that would take away from all that fear, right? Because then it would be over quicker and they wouldn't be afraid of what's happening
next. They got to marinate in that fear.
Yeah. Exactly. Oh, in so many ways.
Yeah.
Gross.
I love the way the new Pennywise looks. The new costume, you know, it's really something you think of a clown, you know, from a couple hundred years ago. You know, the silver and orange is more in keeping with the book, and the weird teeth. Mm-hmm. You know, when I first saw pictures of what he was going to look like, I wasn't sure what I thought about it, but it's very distinctive. It's a little bit silly. I love it. What do you guys think of those kind of almost bunny-like teeth?
Bunny.
I was obsessed with his mouth. To be honest, every time he spoke, I couldn't stop staring at his mouth.
Yeah.
It was just a combination of the weird buck teeth and like his and really kind of like, yeah, he was always drooling and like his lips were always really wet and kind of cushiony. It's like, there's just a lot of texture happening around his mouth and I couldn't stop watching it. Except when his eyes started rolling around weird. That's the only thing that would distract him from his mouth.
Yeah, I think they nailed it with Pennywise.
I had to go back and look at a picture of Bill Skarsgård afterwards because I thought, does his mouth really look like that? Like his, I didn't remember him having such big, like fluffy lips before. Because he really kind of like protrudes his lips in a particular way where it always looks like his mouth is sort of coming off his face a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think adds to that like unnatural, it's not quite a human look.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's supposed to look like a human, but it's not quite doing it right.
Uncanny, as it's called.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is so much of what makes clowns what they are to us, you know. Unnerving at best, you know, horrific.
Well, so speaking of that, the idea of the twisted trickster has been around for far, far longer than some people might think. June, where does this image and idea first start popping up in history?
Well, one thing before we dig into the history of clowns is there's a little bit of a problem of definition, even to this day. You know, is it a mime? Is it a clown? You know, a joker, a jester? Mm-hmm. I'm going to say a clown is, you know, any performer who deals in exaggerated costume, exaggerated face paint, is doing, you know, performance art, joke. They may be joking. They may be silent. I think we all have a pretty good idea of what that is. You know, some people would say that the first clown is found a history at a lot of different points. And we'll talk about that where certain points in time where certain clown historians will say, this here is your first clown. Clowns are all over the world, Native American tribes, Mesoamerica, China, Africa. They can be found everywhere. We know that as early as 2500 BCE, the Egyptians had clowns coming in from other parts of Africa. Hmm. In Imperial China, there was a clown whose name translates to Twisty Pole, which is very, very clowny. He was the only person who could talk reason into the emperor to not put some crazy paint on the Great Wall of China. Now, this may be, you know, apocryphal, but it goes to show that, you know, the court jester is often the only person who can speak the truth with impunity.
Mm-hmm.
In Greece and Rome, we start seeing some weird clowns. Now, this is a good time to point out that clowns, except for a little blip in pretty, you know, fairly modern history, this is adult entertainment. This isn't for children. You know, a lot of clowns right now are very angry about the scary clown phenomena and that it's hurting their reputation with children, hurting their career, which I think is a legitimate grievance. But if they look to their own history, they're going to have to see that there's always been a dark side here. In Greece and Rome, you know, clowns are, they're often very sexualized. They're wearing big phalluses. They've got big padded bodies. They're beating on each other, rolling around, doing flips and things like that, that we would associate with a lot of slapstick humor. In Rome, the aristocratic families often had, you know, clowns and mimes just working in the house to torment their dinner guest and, you know, bring merriment and things like that. But a certain job developed in the ancient Roman world of the funeral clown or the funeral mime.
Interesting.
And this person's job would be to show up at the funeral and imitate the dead guy, talk like him, maybe even wear a mask. Sometimes they would have several coming
in. That's macabre.
Like at a... Yeah, it is, yeah, the funeral clowns. But, you know, I kind of love it. And from what accounts we have, it wasn't always, you know, laughing and making fun of the deceased person. Sometimes it was a little more somber, but there was definitely a carnivalesque aspect to all of this. We know at the funeral of Emperor Vespasian that there was a very famous clown who came in and joked about, you know, he's pretending to be Vespasian. He was joking about how stingy he was, and it was a big hit. I think that it's also important to point out are you guys familiar with Saturnalia, the ancient Roman kind of midwinter festival?
No.
there's a lot of talk about this may have been a time for human sacrifice. What's that old movie? The Wicker Man.
Oh, okay.
Was somewhat based off some of this. So in the Saturnalia in the Roman world, there'd be kind of a flip-flop for a little while where the local the local or the household clown or joker figure would assume the responsibility of the head of the house, and everybody kind of flip-flop positions, and it was just a wild thing, and, you know, may even last for a couple of days. This carried into the Middle Ages in England and France, and the church did not like this, as this got into some really weird stuff where somebody, usually a local clown, would become the bishop for a day or two. And there was a lot of freaky, blasphemous things going on. I should also note why I'm talking about this weird kind of midwinter festival that involves some dark clown behavior, that there are some accounts that at the end of Saturnalia, the clown who has become the aristocrat gets ritually sacrificed.
Oh, my.
Fun.
Yeah. Our sources are a little dubious, and it's hard to come to a consensus there, but plenty of people believed it.
Wow.
Yeah. That's a rough job.
So when you've got rich Roman people who have, you know, clowns on hire, this kind of carries into the Middle Ages, where we've got court jesters who, you know, really hold down the clown scene for a couple of hundred years. You've got images, I think some of the first ones you see are from the late 1200s, early 1300s. Images that we would recognize, funny headdresses, patchy clothes. And there's all these contemporary accounts about how this is always the person who can say what nobody else can. And they're kind of a marginalized figure, kind of a liminal person. They're kind of outside of the law, and yet they have a really high place of power and prestige in some ways, and they're able to say anything. Same time, they're also looked down upon because they're an actor and just kind of outside of society. One of these guys, oh, and I'll say, you know, Shakespeare, 1500, starts writing about clowns and helps cement their popularity. There's a guy named Archie Armstrong from the 1600s, and he was the jester for both Charles and James I, who were Stuart kings. He started out as a thief. His clown skills got him a lot of popularity at court. He became a great man of money and wealth and influence, but he was he just went too far with his jokes and was banished. After he was banished, he continued to write angry poems and letters, but he was just a reviled, hated court jester. Most of the ones I read about, everybody loved, not this guy. So I think he's kind of worth mentioning. So we're going to get into some dark clowns here. Around the late 1600s in Italy, the Commedia dell'Arte, they're a traveling troupe of performers. They start having these stock characters of clowns, and some of these are going to sound pretty familiar to you. Harlequin is a big one. Now, Harlequin is one of those where a lot of clown historians will say this is your proto-clown. This is the first real clown. Harlequin has some interesting history. It's tied in with some kind of rural, rustic Italian folklore. Harlequin is kind of a flying devil or a sorcerer. Even as a clown, he still has a magical staff and a weird little headdress and is able to kind of do some magical acts. Harlequin today is obviously still an image that has stayed with us. Harley Quinn, Suicide Squad, a recent one there. Another one is of these Commedia dell'Arte clowns was I'm not sure if I'm saying this right, Pulcinella. This is going to become the crazy, child-killing, wife-beating puppet clown Mr. Punch, who I'll talk about in a moment. And then another one is Piero. Now, this is the guy who I think everybody's seen and maybe they think of as a sad clown. He's got the white face, a few little black accents. His costume is just white and black, doesn't talk. Kind of a gloomy goth kind of character.
Is that the same sort of character that Pagliacci was based on?
That who?
Pagliacci.
I don't know Pagliacci.
Pagliacci, it was an Italian opera in 1892.
Oh, the one where the guy kills his wife.
Yes.
Yes, yes, indeed. That's actually in my notes as for some 1800s bad clown action. You're absolutely right. And it's going to be, I'm going to talk about a real life killing clown who was also a Piero clown. So these characters in the Commedia dell'Arte, they're going to become very popular. And for the next 200 years or so, clowns are on stage and they kind of work off of this pattern. When you get into the 1800s, we're going to start seeing the circus for the first time. And that's going to lead to a whole different kind of clowning, which isn't necessarily scary or bad, but it is worth mentioning that this is the time when the circus pops up. The piece that that Jackie just mentioned from the late 1800s, another one was similar to that. There was a French play with the same story. This Pierrot-type clown finds his wife cheating and kills her. Wildly popular.
From what I've read, it's speculated that Ruggiero actually copied the Pierrot clown.
Yes. Yeah. So there was a French writer, Edmond de Goncourt, who was writing about these plays and operas and about clowns in general. And he's just, you know, when he's writing about clowns are not funny, they're actually really creepy. And one of his quotes is that they're modern phantoms of the night. He was saying in a way that they're, you know, kind of the next boogeyman to come up. And I think he wrote that passage maybe in 1897. So we can say that even before the 1900s, people were kind of going, about these guys. Okay, so another of those Italian clowns, Pulcinella, is going to become Mr. Punch of the Mr. Punch and Judy puppet shows. These popped up all over England, and they're still happening. They happen to influence both Clive Barker and Neil Gaiman, who I learned earlier. Neil Gaiman wrote a graphic novel about this clown, Mr. Punch.
Did he? Which graphic novel?
I believe it's called The Tragic Comedy of Mr. Punch, or maybe The Comical Tragedy of Mr. Punch, and it's from 1994. Oh. And it might have been a DC publication. Anyway, I'm definitely going to be tracking it down. But just to talk about Mr. Punch for a minute, these shows are all over England on the side of the road. They're little puppets, and Mr. Punch is modeled after the Punchinella clown, or Pulcinella clown. He's got a big hook nose, a little kind of triangular hat, pop eyes, and kind of a big chin. He's a monster. One of the staples in his act is that his baby cries too much, so he throws him out of the window. He beats his wife all the time. He beats anybody who comes near him, pretty much. I think he even beats death himself, literally. Oh, wow. He's just an ornery, violent, pop-eyed, vicious clown puppet who I think more of us need to be acquainted
with. What a little shit.
Yeah, so and these little puppet shows are still happening in England. So the 1800s, you know, we've got this stuff going on. And while we're in the 1800s, I want to talk about two real-life clowns who had a dark story to them. The first of these is Jean-Gaspard Devereaux. He's a French clown. And you can actually see him in a 1945 film called The Children of Paradise. Marcel Carnet, I think, was the director of that. And I think it's one of those kind of art house films, and I don't think he talks much, but you can look at this guy and all his Pierrot fineness. This guy was an alcoholic. He was a laudanum addict. He had a very awful personality. It was said that he would only smile after the sun went down. A big-time depressive. One of these classic cases where the person has a miserable life, but as a performer, they're able to do, you know, something entirely different. You would never guess. There was a bad day, however, where he was going for a stroll, and there was, some accounts say it was a young man, some accounts say it's just a little boy, but somebody who recognized him was just saying, oh, hey, clown man, you know, something, just kind of pestering him, and he takes his walking cane, bashes the man or the kid over the head, and he just dies.
Oh, wow.
He goes to trial, and he's only in prison for, a month, and they say, what a great, oh, he was just a star prisoner, you know, such a cheery disposition, great fella, just kind of got acquitted, swept under the rug. Another one in the 1800s, and this is in England, and I want to make a note that when we think of red, bright red hair and a lot of this white face clown makeup with colory patches, that started in England around this time with the slapstick tradition. And this person here, Joseph Grimaldi, I think that most of the clown enthusiasts are going to say this is your first real clown. If you see images of him, he's got a white face, crazy red hair, he's got the patchy clothes, pom-poms, little blue and red triangles. He was very famous, and he's the reason clowns, I guess, in England are called Joeys still to this day. His father was a clown, a very abusive, alcoholic man who kept his children in just a grip of terror of him. But Joseph was able to bond with him because he was interested in his work, and he passed these skills on to Joseph, who himself was a horrible alcoholic, really, really struggled, and he was a terrible depressive. He made a joke about his name, his last name, Grimaldi. He said that was his name because he's grim all day, but at night he'll make you laugh. He didn't live for very long and I think died. I'm not sure the circumstances of his death, but people who saw him performing would always comment on, wow, his clown makeup is almost scary. You know, he's got this big cavernous red mouth and he almost looks kind of corpse-like, you know, with the stuff around his eyes and the white face. And he acts insane. So, Andrew McConnell Stott is a big serious historian of this guy. And he says, and I think he makes a really good argument, that Charles Dickens writing about this fellow is where we get the idea of the scary clown, or the clown as something to hide. Huh. And here's why. Charles Dickens, oddly, before he became, you know, more well-known, was the person who transcribed and published Joseph Grimaldi's memoirs. And they're fascinating to read. But before Charles Dickens got a hold of this, he had already written, in 1836, the Pickwick Papers, which was inspired by the Grimaldis themselves. And one of the things Charles Dickens really saw in these clowns, these Grimaldis, was that they're hiding something. They hide under all this wild behavior and paint, but they're really miserable. There's something under the paint. They're sad. They're struggling with addiction. They're, you know, always at death's door. And Charles Dickens' Pickwick Papers, I mean, he really, really hammers that home. And Dickens being, you know, popular and influential, really may have planted the seed here that, you know, clowns are hiding something dark underneath all that laughter.
Huh, that's pretty interesting.
After Joseph Grimaldi, I mean, all the clowns that you see, you know, are kind of patting, you know, wild behavior, you know, wild laughing. We were talking about with Pennywise, this erratic and unpredictable body movements, you know, which is such a big part of clowning today. He also, his slapstick stunts were extremely violent and he was breaking his own bones all the time. I mean, this man was constantly had a broken bone, a sprain, this or that, and he lived his life in pain for his art.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's intense.
That is intense. So you get into the 20th century, you know, circus is still popular, and I think this is a time where clowns kind of really do become child's play for a while. You've got them on TV, the circus, you know, they're hanging with the kids. Clowns start doing things like ministry work and going to hospitals and even change their persona a little bit. But around this time, we also have to recognize something that Stephen King recognized and included in a passage in the novel It. The Joker comes about. And a lot of people, I don't think of Joker in this museum of creepy clowns. I mean, maybe because he's a comic book villain and is dealing more with heroes and villains and all that. But when the kids in It are trying to wrap their mind around, could there be a killer clown? One of them, I don't know which one it is, says, well, of course. I mean, just think about the Joker.
Yeah.
And they all go, oh, yeah. You know, this is already a, you know, a familiar idea. And from then on, I mean, as we all well know, there's tons and tons of clown movies, clown comics, real life stories of scary clown things going on. I think that the clown really lends itself well as a boogeyman, and we love it. And I don't think that's going to change anytime soon.
Yeah.
And we even have now new clown controversies. One is, did Stephen King invent coulrophobia? I don't think so. Another is professional clowns being unfairly maligned by the interest in killer clowns. I don't think so either. I mean, I'm sure their jobs are hurting, but
that seems odd that anyone would speculate that Stephen King invented coulrophobia.
I think it's just because it was so, you know, Curry's Pennywise was just so iconic.
I know one psychologist has recently mentioned that Pennywise is basically the very modernization of evil clown. Like, it is absolutely the iconic evil clown.
I could not argue that, even much more so than the Joker. Now, this book I recommended by Benjamin Radford, Bad Clowns, he makes a really good argument that the Joker is the most well-known bad clown because it's such a global thing, but I don't think of the Joker as a clown, really.
Yeah, he will always be, but yeah. He's very disassociated from that image, which is
It's always going to be Pennywise for me.
Yeah. It's weird how the Joker has become so separated from that image, even though he's walking around in clown makeup.
Yeah.
He lives in a defunct circus in a lot of iterations.
And there's, I think, three Joker movies coming up. An origin story, which I'm very curious about, as well as some Suicide Squad stuff, I think.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some real-life creepy clowns. Sierra, I know that you have a lot of thoughts on John Wayne Gacy.
He has a pretty typical serial killer background growing up. He's the middle child. He has two sisters. His father was a horrible person. He beat John. He said that John was too feminine because he liked things like cooking and gardening. And he told him, his father told him he was going to be queer and would beat him about that. And no matter what John did, he couldn't really get his father's approval. And when he was 9 years old, he and a friend got caught assaulting a girl. And so his dad beat him like really hard over that. And then in that same year, he was molested by a family friend who was an adult and didn't tell his dad about that because he thought he'd get beaten up again. And then just to put a cherry on the top of everything, when he was 11, he got hit in the head with a swing, which is ironic because Richard Ramirez, who was the Night Stalker, was also hit in the head in the same way. And there, a lot of serial killers have had head traumas, and like that might be a reason that their brains aren't working as well as they should be. John had a really terrible childhood, a lot of abuse, and especially abuse around sexualized things. And then when he was 19, he didn't graduate from high school, so he moved away from his home in Chicago to Las Vegas, and he started working as a mortuary assistant. While he was working at the morgue, he slept in a cot behind the embalming room, which just really hammering the nail into his whole MO.
Yeah.
He would watch morticians embalming dead bodies, and then he confessed that one time when he was alone, he opened a coffin of a deceased teen boy and was like massaging him and stuff, and then felt really shocked by that. And so he kind of scared himself a little bit, and he called his mom, ended up moving back to Chicago, where he went to business school. And he gets married, he has two kids, buys three KFCs in Waterloo, Iowa, and he makes all of his employees call him the Colonel.
I didn't know about that. That's
lovely. I didn't either. Wow. I just thought Captain Spaulding, too.
And Kentucky Fried KFC comes up again later. At this point, his wife gives birth in 1966, and the day that his first child was born, he goes and has an affair with a man. And so that kind of like starts his double life and kind of hiding his homosexuality. And then a year later is his first sexual assault of a teenage boy. This boy, he lures him to his house, gets him drunk, and assaults him. And so this boy, Donald Voorhees, tells his dad about it, and the police arrest John Wayne Gacy, but only after Gacy hires another teenage boy to go and beat up Voorhees to try to make him stay quiet about it.
Oh, wow.
Which is just lovely. Gacy is submitted for a psychiatric evaluation, and he's diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, and he's called a sociopath and a psychopath. The doctors there recommend that he's never released because there's like no way he can be rehabilitated, and he's sentenced to 10 years for sodomy. But then, of course, 18 months later, he's granted parole because of good behavior. So he's back on the streets after about a year and a half. He gets out in 1970. In 1971, he starts his famous painting, decorating, maintenance company and starts to hire teenage boys, which is like his way to bring people into his house. And in 1972 is his first murder. He picks up this boy, Timothy, from a Greyhound station. He's a runaway, and he takes him back to his house and rapes him and murders him and hides him in the floorboards. And that is the very first murder.
That's very Edgar Allan Poe of him.
Mm-hmm. Yep. He has a very famous crawl space in his house where eventually 27 bodies are found in the crawl space. Eesh. Yeah, so that ties him over for a little bit. He doesn't murder anybody for another 2 years. And then in 1975 is when he starts dressing up as Pogo the Clown. I guess there's a rule in clowning where your makeup is supposed to be rounded, like everything around your eyes and your mouth, they're supposed to be curved.
Mm-hmm.
But Gacy makes everything really pointed and these like really sharp angles. So if you look at pictures of him and his clown makeup, it's super creepy. And like, I think he kind of knows what he's doing by making it so like sharp and weird.
That's an interesting detail.
Yeah. And so his kind of famous way of murdering folks is that he lures these boys into his house and then tells them you know, I'm Pogo the Clown. I'm going to show you a trick. And so he takes out like a rope or a handcuff and he's like, I'm going to show you this magic trick. And then he just ties them up or handcuffs them and then assaults them and murders them, oof, which is just a great trick.
Just wonderful.
Yeah. He really goes crazy in the years 76 to 78. He called them his cruising years. And at that time, he was murdering somebody every 2 to 3 weeks. And he's finally caught, thank God. When police go into his house, they find 27 bodies, like I said. And then he also apparently, like, dumped some bodies in a river nearby, too. So he's eventually charged with 33 murders. And he gets sentenced to death. His final meal was a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Ooh.
And a dozen fried shrimp, french fries, strawberries, and a Diet Coke.
Hmm.
So that's John Wayne Gacy in a nutshell. he did a lot of fucked up shit. And my favorite murder and That's Why We Drink both have episodes about him, which are really good. And they go into more detail about the various murders and the victims of those murders. So if anybody's interested in true crime, they should totally check those out. Yeah. And I found out today that just a month or two ago, yeah, back in July, one of the victims was finally identified, who was found at his house through DNA evidence. So,
wow,
40 years later, they're still identifying the victims of his crimes.
That is crazy.
Mm-hmm. I feel like John Wayne Gacy plays a part in the whole cultural associating clowns with horror, just a little bit. I think he might have influenced Stephen King just a tiny bit.
Just a touch.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
And I think that the reality of John Wayne Gacy and Pogo the Clown probably really, really, more than anything, probably did just cement the idea, you know, in the 20th century, right, of clowns as, you know.
Well, and also you were talking about, like, in the 1900s or so, it kind of, clowning takes a turn into being this childhood thing. Yes. And it's like performing for children. And then he's doing all of these murders in the 60s and 70s, which then kind of spark the whole stranger danger, mm-hmm, wave of like not letting kids go outside, not letting them walk to school alone or walk somewhere alone, not talking to strangers kind of thing. And that like mass hysteria, your kids are going to get kidnapped and horrible things done to them.
Huh.
Probably by clowns.
Here's a kind of a weird question. In your research there, any of you, honestly, on John Wayne Gacy, did you come across any references that he was an Edgar Allan Poe fan?
I don't think so. I think it was just convenient that he had this space under his house that he could store victims.
It's not just that. Edgar Allan Poe had a story called Hop Frog, which involved an evil clown as well.
Oh.
I have not heard of that at all.
Yeah. It's kind of weird that kind of two sort of Poe references in his clowning there.
Maybe he was. He didn't seem like he did very well in school, but he was definitely a sociopath. So he was very good at telling people what they wanted to hear and kind of making them put their guard down. And I think that's why he was seen as like a pretty stand-up guy in his community, and everybody kind of trusted him, which is why he got away with it for so long.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, helped with him kind of being a clown too, is like, oh, he's just, you can trust him with your kids. And he like had that whole persona that made people let their guard down.
Yeah, that definitely seems like a very creepy characteristic of the whole evil clown trope, is that your clowns are the kind of thing that you would invite to a kid's birthday party. So it's the kind of thing that you, I mean, in modern days, at least, the kind of thing that you would expect to be able to be okay with around your kids, but clearly not.
Yeah, the proximity to children.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unpredictable behavior, hidden emotions, you know, but I had distorting face makeup. There's so many things that we could pick apart that make, you know, hey, clowns terrifying.
On the subject of real life clowns, let's talk about the creepy clown sightings in the past few years. The fact that there have been real life creepy clown sightings and that they're on the rise is just like one of the most terrifying things I've said out loud.
Yeah, that was like there was a couple of weeks last year where I felt like every day there was like a new scary clown story going around Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah.
From what I understand, that things really only got like broke beyond just like a crown kind of creeping and beckoning in France. I understand that there really was some criminal activity associated with, I guess, in 2014. I did read something, skimming over something, but there have been several different waves of, I guess, what they call phantom clowns. This happened in the 80s, too.
Does it seem like they have been tied to any event, like anything inspiring people to just clown up and head around in public there?
Not, I think that the stuff in the 80s was blamed on fears about, yeah, Pogo the Clown, it. There was I did read something. I have to try to come across that, where one of the rashes of clown sightings, which made things get really easily dismissed, is that they were described and seriously as being like Homie the Clown from In Living Color.
Right.
When that was current. Like, oh, all of a sudden there's somebody looks like Homie the Clown doing this. And I don't know, do you guys consider like the Joker-inspired killings, like the movie theater killings and the couple in Las Vegas, would you consider that part of this wave of bad clown activity?
That's an interesting question.
I don't know if I feel like it's in the same place in my mind. I think that it's the Joker kind of represents this like anarchist, like do what's best for the masses because they don't know what's best for them kind of mentality, and like going to show them the way, which isn't necessarily, I don't know if I super associate that with clowns so much as just like assholes.
Yeah, assholes in clown garb.
Really, yeah. Really dangerous people who think that they know what's best for people.
Yeah.
I wonder if this year around Halloween, it's really going to spike again.
Oh, you know, with
Yeah, I've actually read a couple of accounts of police departments just expecting to try to curb clown behavior, like for this coming Halloween and such, so... That's a weird thing to have to plan for.
I've been watching the newest episodes of American Horror Story. I've been seeing these ads for very tongue-in-cheek involving the sitcom Baskets.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That talk about, like, I think it's some organization Honk Honor Our Nation's Clowns or something like that. And it talking about, you know, clowns aren't all scary. And it's like, that's pretty cute.
Yeah. Baskets is a fun show. It's not really about an evil clown, but about a sad clown, mostly. Mm-hmm. Melissa, you've been very quiet over there. I'm getting worried. Have clowns taken you?
You got eaten by the clowns.
No, I'm okay. To be honest, other than Pennywise, I never really found clowns to be very scary.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in all the information that is being shared here, because it's never been a point of like of big interest for me in the horror realm, you know?
Right.
So I'm learning and listening and taking in all the new information.
I'm curious what other clown movies we've seen that might be worth mentioning.
Have you seen Killer Clowns from Outer Space?
Oh yes, several times. I reviewed it recently. That was great.
That's honestly one of my favorites. It's so ridiculous.
Yeah, and that was 88, so that was, before the It movie was
closed. But gosh, yeah,
the popcorn gun.
A list of 40 clown horror movies.
Yeah, we actually have at least like half a dozen clown movies sitting on our home server here ready to watch that we haven't gotten to yet.
Oh, nice. What about, there's one 2013, All Hallows Eve. Now, it's a low-budget film on Amazon Prime. I don't know if it's Prime, but it's one of those things where it's like little films that are connected, and the connecting element is a clown that's probably the second scariest clown, Art the Clown. He is by far the most terrifying thing about that movie.
Huh.
And if you want a clown to creep you out again, that'd be a good choice, even though the, little films that comprise the body of it aren't all that.
Which one of you put Pee-wee's Big Adventure on our list of creepy
clowns? That's scary clowns! It's like the Doctor Clowns or whatever.
Oh, I don't think I remember those.
Well, Not a horror clown, but who's seen Shakes the Clown?
That sounds so familiar. I have to look it up.
It's 1991. What's the comedian? Bobcat.
Goldthwait.
Yes, I can never say that right. So this is a clown movie that made a lot of clowns angry because, and it's funny, the film, I think it says on its poster that it is the Citizen Kane of alcoholic clown film. It's got a great Robin Williams cameo. I think it might be Adam Sandler's first movie, but it takes place in a really weird clown town. Like there's a clown bar where all the clowns hang out. It's worth a view. It's silly. Huh.
That sounds fun.
I just found one that looks really creepy, actually. It's from 1924. It's called Who Gets Slapped.
Lon Chaney.
A silent film with Lon Chaney. It says, Lon Chaney is a clown with a grudge against a perverted old count.
It's a sad film, and boy.
I just did a quick image search on it, and he is a pretty creepy looking clown. Mm-hmm.
And that would be, I think that's the oldest dark clown movie that I could find. Ooh, and it is the screenshots from that are really
really he is spooky. Creepy looking.
He Who Gets Slapped.
Yeah. Lon Chaney and Norma Shearer.
Like weird like tufts of three little tufts of hair on his head.
Yeah, he's a problem. Look at that.
And then he's also in one called a few years later called Laugh Clown Laugh.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Not as dark as He Who Gets Slapped. I noticed somebody put Killjoy on the list. Yeah. Love it.
And we have talked about Captain Spaulding a couple times, but House of a Thousand Corpses and Devil's Reject there.
Definitely Captain Spaulding was my favorite part. I really love that he was just a gritty, gross. Yeah. Oh, those teeth. I love that.
Yeah, he pulls away from just the like basic psychology of being afraid of clowns into like just the gross, creepy human that you don't want to be around.
Mm-hmm. And I was hoping that that kind of gritty human, gross clown, that would be something that I would see when I watched 31.
Oh, yeah.
And I did not like that film. Very much. I think there were two clowns, and I was like,
gone off the rails a little bit lately.
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen that.
Gosh, I guess that came out last year.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
Yep, 2016. So it's this thing, you know, one of those kind of survival killer slasher things where they're in some kind of warehouse playing a game that they don't want to play. And the people playing this game, by the way, are supposed to be circus people or carny people, but you would never really know that except for... They say that's who that is. I didn't like that in any way. Like, what did they do? They juggle? You don't know. that just bothered me. But anyway, they end up, I guess they're abducted or something. They're in this warehouse, and it's like, fight all these killer clowns. But the clowns were not very clowny.
Mm.
I did read something where Rob Zombie was like, it just got to be too much work, you know, to put all, you know, do all the makeup. So we just made it really minimal. And
mm-hmm.
That just sounds lazy. And I like that it was still...
Yeah,
that's what I thought, yeah. So instead of being this gritty kind of, you know, Spaulding kind of thing, I don't know, it just didn't have it for me.
So the funny thing is while we were talking about him, my thought was, you know, I have trouble even thinking of him as a clown because I always thought when I saw his character that the makeup and everything just kind of looks like a lazy sort of afterthought, like he just smudged some stuff on his face to look like weird.
Right.
And then, you know, he's not even like done up enough for me to think of him enough as a clown. So it's funny that you say that it was just kind of like
that's
a lazy.
Which works for Spaulding. Yeah. You know, really that, this is what I do. My clown shtick.
Yeah. That definitely works for Spaulding, but it does break that image of the obscured face, the obscured clownness.
Mm-hmm.
So, I want to add one here and just say, I think that Twisty, the clown from American Horror Story, mm-hmm. I think that he had a lot of great potential and they sort of dropped the ball on that character.
That's kind of their MO on that show in general.
To be honest, we haven't, we haven't even watched the recent one. We really fell off.
I love the new one.
we've been going for too long.
But he was a cool clown. I thought he was a cool, genuinely creepy clown, especially since he didn't speak.
Oh, definitely.
And that's a big thing, the silent clown. Yeah. Ooh,
when and when a clown is that, like, even worse. Just a giant, tall human being and is, like, very imposing over any kind of young woman or small child who he's attacking.
Well, I don't want to spoil anything, but I can tell you that in a weird way, Twisty is back. And the new season of American Horror Story is full of clowns.
Huh. The cult one?
Huh. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
I think, they're only two episodes in. But I'll just leave that at that. And something popped into my head when Sierra was talking about Pogo, John Wayne Gacy. I came across a film, what is it called? Funny or Die. And the fellow who put it together, it's one of those, it's just like a bunch of little mini movies in one. Got my notes for this. The fellow who made the movie put a skit in it called Clowned. And it's about a guy who's just minding his own business and some crazy clown comes up and bites him. He fights him off. And then, but later he's turning into a cannibal clown, almost like a werewolf.
Like a were clown?
Yeah.
That's funny.
And it's a very, very silly short, except for I read a thing with a guy who did the movie and he said, I actually hate clowns. Like, I really hate them because he went to school with the boy who was Gacy's first victim.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
and he said, you know, he'll never unlock that. And I think that maybe that the clown skit that he did was a way of kind of addressing all of that for him.
Huh.
But, he said his aversion's a clown. He's not scared of them. He just hates them. The same fellow who wrote this clown also got spat on by the original real Lobster Boy.
Oh, wow.
Oh.
So he doesn't like Lobster Boys either.
Huh. That's fair. That's a very interesting history.
I wouldn't like anyone who said that.
Little tie-in.
Wow.
Let's see. I'm trying to think of other... Oh, how about The Last Circus? Has anybody seen that one?
No.
It's a Spanish film. Alex de Iglesias, I think, is the director. It takes place during the Spanish Civil War. And it's about a sad clown and kind of an angry clown and a love triangle with a... I guess she would say she's a trapeze artist. But it's not as much scary. It's clowns doing wrong and getting deranged and going out for some revenge. It's not as much, you know, like a Pogo type clown. They've got, you know, personal business. You know, they're broken hearts here. But it's a really pretty film. Just something a little different, kind of surreal. Not necessarily horror, but I think it's one worth seeing.
Interesting.
I just came across an interesting one from 1988. It's called Out of the Dark.
Never heard of that.
Plot is workers at a phone sex company are stalked by a deranged clown.
Oh, sounds good. You said that was 19.
Which is a really weird combination.
We're gonna have to just include this entire list in the show notes.
I think so.
This is great.
And how about any of y'all seen Stitches?
No, that one's on my server to watch too.
It's been on my Netflix for a minute, and you know I started watching movies. I gave it a whirl and I liked it a lot more than I expected. There is a clown mausoleum, I'll tell you that.
That's interesting.
Yes.
There's also a documentary called Capturing the Freedmans from 2003. Mm-hmm. Documentary. Started as a short film about popular kids clown David Silly Billy Friedman and became a harrowing full-length documentary when director uncovered horrifying evidence of pedophilia within the Friedman family.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
What's that one called? Capturing the
Friedmans? Sorry, guys, that just got real dark.
Well, I mean, as things with clowns do.
Yeah.
Gotta go find that one.
Whoa, a real clown story? Yeah. What?
Yeah, I think clowns have never really scared me that much, but I think part of what I do find super creepy is that they have spilled into the real world a little too much.
Yes.
Just a bit too much.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like the kind of people who think it's really funny are also the kind of people that I don't trust. And so anybody who would like dress up as a clown, like as a goof, are like not the kind of people I want to be around and like have them try to scare me in public.
Another thing I want to mention here that we'd like to include here, there's a great Vulture article about the psychology behind creepy clowns, and it's an interview with the Harvard Medical School psychiatrist and fright film fan, Stephen Schultzman. Apparently, he actually teaches an undergraduate course on the psychology of horror in general. So I would like to sit in his class personally, but Vulture did a really great article with him about why people are afraid of clowns. That'll give you some insight there for sure.
Did it talk about the paint aspect, kind of like what Sierra was talking about, like the shapes of the paint, you know, the eyebrows and the nose and things like that?
Or? I don't think that came into play there from what I remember on that, but that is a very interesting aspect. I never realized that there was any kind of code there.
I think that, like, when you go to clown school, you learn how to put on makeup and you create your persona under these certain guidelines of, like, what a clown should and shouldn't do. Huh.
Like, I really want to research that more. That's a very strange detail.
Yeah, and once you pick the clown persona, you draw it on an egg or paint it on an egg, which is put in a case, and these are saved. Like, there's museums of these.
Oh, wow, really?
And actually, this shows up in the horror movie Stitches, too, which I liked because that's some real clown history. But yeah, they really frown on straight, you know, or angular things that can look menacing or hostile.
Huh. There's so much more to clowns than I ever realized there was.
It's funny when you go and look at like images of this guy Joseph Grimaldi. I'm grim all day. You look at his face paint and it's pretty spiky and kind of garish and scary.
Yeah. Well, I can respect that. Well,
yeah.
Do any of you have anything else more to say about clowns this evening? Wow. Been a very weird clowning interesting evening here. Melissa sounds not amused.
No, I'm amused. I learned a lot about clowns tonight.
I bet in 6 months we'll be clowned out. I just really see this getting really big for a minute.
It's gonna be the next zombies. I'm so done with zombies.
Oh, Jackie, so well said. And you of all people would know about. Yeah.
Sirens and Scream is a member of the Mega Nerd Media family. Visit meganerdmedia.com for geek-related columns, reviews, interviews, and videos. If you've been enjoying our happy little horror show, please remember to leave us a rating on things like iTunes and Stitcher. These help us grow our audience so we can keep doing these cool things. So we really want to hear from you. Make sure to leave us reviews. We also love being guests on other podcasts. So if you have a guest you'd like for us to sit in on or a suggestion for us, we're all ears. You can reach us via email at sos@meganerdmedia.com, on Twitter and Tumblr and Facebook at Sirens of Scream. And you can find past episodes, show notes, recommendation links, and more at sirensofscream.com. Melissa, where can listeners find you?
You can find me at Lissa Punch on Twitter and Instagram. And you can also hear me on the Talking Comics podcast now.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Sierra, where can listeners find you?
I'm at Sierra Houck on the internet.
And I am Jackie the Robot on Twitter and Instagram. And June, you can find her on Facebook. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's about anywhere I have a tentative presence established so far. June Gregory, yes. And you can link all me.
Right. Cool. And that's a wrap for this episode. Next time, we'll be undertaking a whole new and fresh batch of horror recommendations for another 31 Days of Horror.
See the funny little clown, see him laughing as you walk by. Everybody thinks he's happy 'cause you never see a tear in his eye. No one knows he's crying, and no one knows he's dying on the inside. 'Cause he's laughing on the outside. No one knows. No one knows. See the funny little clown, he's hiding behind his smile. They all think he's laughing, but I know he's really crying all the while. How his heart is aching, and how his heart is breaking on the inside. But he keeps laughing on the outside. No one knows. No one knows. This funny little clown, you never used to see him around. Without his girl beside him to love and guide him. Until one day his girl just walked away, and to this very day he says he never loved her anyway. And no one knows except for me, because you see, I'm that funny little clown. See the funny little clown.